Our four panelists are most likely quite well known to you, so I will not give them the rich and flowery introductions they so richly deserve, but simply introduce them in their roles, or some of them. We will go in alphabetical order. Our first speaker will be Guy Debelle. Guy is Assistant Governor of Financial Markets of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Guy will be followed by Peter Higham. Peter is Deputy Chief Executive Officer, Australian Securities Exchange. After Peter, Heather Ridout will speak. Heather brings multiple perspectives as she is both a board member of the Reserve Bank of Australia and the ASX, as well as chairman of Australia's largest industry fund, Australian Super. I think she will emphasise that superannuation hat in her remarks today. And finally, Steve Tucker is well known to you as the former CEO of MLC and a board member of the Financial Services Council. He's currently active in the Superannuation Charter Group and brings a wealth of investment, industry and super experience. So thanks everyone for agreeing to do this. I'm going to now start it off with Guy.
See if I can master technology as far as it goes. Thanks, Jeremy. So as I said at the launch of these papers a few weeks back, the Australian Centre for Financial Studies has put together a very interesting and timely body of work on an important topic. And I want to just make a couple of points today. First is to pick up on something I said a couple of weeks ago and just expand on that a little bit around the sort of review of global financial regulation, which has something to do with the papers we've got in front of us today. And the secondly is more explicitly on where to from here for the project. So at that launch I talked about a few weeks back, I talked about the need for a holistic review of global financial regulation. And I would stand by that. I think it does need to be done at a global level. There is a vast global regulatory reform agenda, and the authors in their papers talk a bit about that, and which is complex and interacting in a number of different ways. And we need a better understanding of how some of these interactions occur. As I said before, each of these regulations may well make sense in their own right and when looked at in terms of their impact on their own particular market segment. I just don't get the sense that we have a good idea on how they all interact and affect market functioning. And that part that's got a fair bit to do with the papers today is that I think one important point that they all make, or way they come about asking this question, is by looking at the system as a whole, and that's a point I'm going to make a number of times, is that it's no point in focusing on one particular market segment and making recommendations around that without thinking about how the system as a whole functions and interacts. So one good example of one of these global regulatory reforms which is having a reasonably large impact on at the moment is on a whole bunch of reforms which have an effect on the demand for collateral out there at the moment. So quite a number of the global reforms require banks as well as others to hold more high-quality collateral than they did in the past. So the shift to central clearing, which doesn't get too much of a run in the papers except possibly Daniels, is one such reform. In a number of cases, margin has always been posted on these transactions, but depending on how the shift actually to central clearing actually occurs, we may or may not get all the benefit of netting, which would mean a greater demand for collateral than we've had in the past. Then there are some transactions on which margin has not previously been required. That's going to increase more the demand for collateral. The sort of collateral which can actually be posted is also changing. If we look at the liquidity reforms under Basel III, that also implies a material increase in demand for high-quality collateral, and I have a bit more to say about that next week. The bottom line is that demand for high-quality collateral is going up. As it so happens, right at the moment, this is occurring at a time where the supply is also going up because of given the fiscal situation around the globe. But nevertheless, that's a sort of longer-term structural issue which Kevin was talking about, as to how that's going to play out over the next decade or so, which is going to have a material impact on the way that the financial system evolves. So what are the implications of that? Is it just an issue of price? So we've got increased demand. At the moment, we've got increased supply, but in the future, we might have decreased supply. So is that just an issue where the price just solves the situation? Or will there be impacts on market functioning? So through the BIS, on the Committee on Global Financial Stability, on which I sit, has published some work on that recently in the last couple of months, but there is more to be done. This is just one example where we don't really know the full implications of the many interacting reforms underway and how that's going to affect the sort of structural forces affecting the financial sector over the next decade or two. That said, what I am not saying is that we should delay implementing some of these reforms in Australia or just pick and choose the ones that the financial sector likes. I do not agree with that. We do not have that luxury. As the papers we are discussing today highlight, the Australian system is part of the global financial system. The capital inflows that the country has experienced over many decades are sourced from the global financial system. Given that, we don't have the option to just opt out when we don't like particular aspects of it. The second point I'd like to make gets right to the heart of the agenda of the papers today, which is funding Australia's future. As I said earlier, it's a very good question to ask. But it's interesting to think about how much further we can go with it. The Australian financial system has undergone a severe stress test over the past 5 or 6 years, and it's come through that pretty well. Are there some things that can be done to make the system function better and be more resilient? Yeah, undoubtedly so, and some of them have already been put in train over the past few years. So the system today, I think, is much more resilient than it was 5 years ago in 2007. Some of those reforms have been done locally, some of them are part of that global reform agenda I was talking about. The fact that the problems didn't happen here is also not a good argument for not implementing the global reforms. The reforms have been developed with the idea of increasing the resiliency of the global financial system, which would seem to me, at least, to make them worthwhile in their own right. The fact that some of these problems didn't eventuate here doesn't mean it's not a good idea to stop them happening here in the future. I don't see the logic in not learning from what happened elsewhere rather than waiting to learn the lesson painfully ourselves. Learning from others' mistakes is generally a lot less painful approach to life. As the past few years show, and this is a point I think which is very important in the way that the papers are structured and the way that the work should go going forward, is that the financial system is just that. It's a system. And that's a point that Rod and Pete make, particularly in their paper. It's also a set of markets where there is a demand and supply and a market clearing price. A lot of work on financial reform in the past has generally focused on one of those three things, either the demand or the supply or the price, without considering the interaction of all three together. As the financial system evolves and is stressed in different parts, other parts of the system adjust. As supply and demand changes, the price adjusts. Does this always happen seamlessly or painlessly? No, it doesn't. But broadly speaking, the stress test of the past few years shows that it does actually happen. There are a lot of people worrying throughout the period of the past 5 or 6 years about where the next dollar of funding was going to come from in Australia. But in the event, the system broadly coped. The system didn't fail. And it's important to keep that point in mind, I think, when thinking about where this work goes from here. We had a fairly decent stress test over the past 5 or 6 years, and broadly speaking, the system worked. It didn't fail. Prices did adjust. The exchange rate, for example, in 2008 was one of those prices which adjusted. Deposit pricing, which Rod talked a fair bit about earlier on, was another price which has adjusted. Do markets always get this price adjustment right? No, they don't. But it's not clear to me what the better alternative is. And the regulation that has been put in place over the last few years and is currently underway is motivated, at least in part, to address some of those deficiencies of the operations of markets. Is the regulation always going to get it right? Clearly it's not. So that's why we need to keep on questioning the appropriateness of the structure of financial markets and their regulation. And it's very, I think it's good to be asking that question in an environment where the system hasn't failed, rather than asking that question, as someone mentioned earlier about the UK, of asking that system in an environment where the system has failed. So in thinking about the future work of the Funding Australia Future program, I think you need to keep on asking the question, is the system working as well as it can? And in terms of the future work agenda, I thought basically Kevin just stuck it up there on one of the slides he put out there, which is there are a broad bunch of structural issues which are look like, you know, which summarise the way the system is evolving at the moment. I think one question which you could add to the questions that Kevin put up on that slide is, so these structural forces are happening, do we actually think that they're beneficial structural changes? So I agree with the structural changes that Kevin identified and that Pete and Rod highlighted as well, but do we just take them as a given, or do we think that we should question whether there's actually something that we're comfortable with or not? Are they well-founded structural changes, or are they generated by some distortion that we're not completely comfortable with? But in thinking about that question, and as I said, I think those are really the issues that the work agenda should focus on going forward, is the broad medium-term structural forces. It is very important, and I think the papers do a good job of this, but it's important to keep on doing that job, is to think about the system as a whole and look at how those broad structural forces are interacting rather than picking and choosing different bits and pieces of them and doing it in a very partial fashion. So I think the agenda, as I said, I think Kevin's basically just stuck it up there on that slide he had earlier on, and I would basically say that's really the direction the future work needs to go. But to add that question is, are we comfortable with the way those structural forces are evolving, and are there things that we think we should change to make sure that some of those structural changes do or don't happen? So with that, let me pass over to you.
I'd like perhaps to get the discussion rolling by asking Dorothy Dixer, and I actually thought Christopher Zinn, writing in the Financial Review this morning, gave us a really good slap around the head, and asking the real question. This is Christopher Zinn from One Big Switch. He said, well, what about the consumer? And Steve's talked about it a little bit, but have we really put the consumer at the center of the issue, and have we taken enough of a consumer view? So I might actually ask the panelists how they think in further research in this topic we ought to think about the consumer.
Guy, did you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to be careful about getting too hung up on some of the micro detail. If you think about when I grew up, which is longer ago than some people might think, but anyway, when I grew up, people used to save through a bank. Now we're talking about saving through a super system. And Kevin made this point very strongly in his paper, is that the vehicle by which this is happening is changing, potentially, from the banks to the super system. A lot of the issues you're looking at in terms of dealing with your customer, Steve raised the issue of liquidity management. Well, banks have a long history, not always successful history, of managing liquidity. And Kevin, again, made this point exactly. The liquidity management issues are now shifting from the banking sector to the super sector. It's not clear to me that the issues are actually all that different. It's a different vehicle doing it. But in terms of one offering something that you're dealing with your different customer preferences and dealing with the liquidity issues, I think there's a fair bit of similarity across the two, between super and the banks. It's just a different vehicle doing it. I mean, a bank has millions of customers. You know, they're used to dealing with that. We know from from history that most of the time, they don't all try and move their money out at the same time. When they do, that's a problem, and we have mechanisms to deal with it. But, you know, a similar situation with super, the law of large numbers actually does kick in here. And yes, there are a vast array of customer preferences, but most of the time, they're not all going to be exercising those preferences in exactly the same way on exactly the same day. On the day they do, yes, that's a problem, and we need to have mechanisms to deal with it. But I think in terms of the work agenda, I think it's actually worth drawing out some of those similarities, and there are some differences too, but there are also a fair bit of similarities between the way the super system is now evolving, and I agree with the point Rod made that it's still a somewhat immature industry, particularly compared to, say, the banking sector, I think. But it's potentially evolving towards something which actually looks going to end up looking not a long, long way away from the way the banking sector at least used to look at, which is mostly a funds manager. And then now the banks are going to be in the world of credit assessment and intermediation. It's going to be the super sector which is going to be doing the funds management.
Well, we do have a fascinating superannuation industry in the sense that it's so heavily defined contribution driven, putting individuals in the real driver's seat, leading the world in that regard. So the consumer is definitely front and centre in superannuation. Andrew.
Thanks. A question for Guy. The G20 has taken steerage of the global regulatory agenda. Australia's taking over the chair of the G20 in the next phase. Given that your point that we can't opt out of the global regulatory agenda, but there should be some kind of holistic view, are there two or three things that you would point to that Australia should particularly focus on if the Australian system is not going to be perhaps discriminated against in the way that the global agenda plays out?
I'm not quite sure about I don't get the global discrimination part, but I can answer the first part of your question. I mean, I think, and I think this has been articulated by Glenn as well as Martin Parkinson, is that, I mean, one of the things we're looking at is basically nothing new, bed down what's actually there over the, next year when we've got the chair. So, it's very, I mean, to some extent, it's very much a consolidation phase. It doesn't, I think, if you look at the timetable, it's over the next year or so that a lot of stuff sort of really comes, becomes concrete, pretty much by the end of next year. So that review I was talking about earlier is really for the year after that, when that stuff's actually all in play. And really the focus over the next 12 months, or at least over 2014 at least, is really bedding down all the various moving parts which are sort of gradually coming together. And I think the next 12 to 18 months is going to be very much the critical time for that. So I think, as I think Glenn's articulated previously, our aim over the next 12 months is or 18 months is just to consolidate what's there and avoid adding anything new to the complexity which is already out there.
Other questions? I did get a tweet that asked a very sort of tough question, and it sort of relates to an experience I had when I went to talk to my ex-boss in the US, Jack Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, and I told him I was working on Mark Johnson's committee to develop Australia as a financial centre, and he said to me, "Now, why the hell would you want to do that? Why would you, in the middle of the financial crisis, why would you want to develop Australia as a financial centre?" And that's a typical blunt Jack Bogle expression. But in that context, I've got a question for the team, and this was really put to me sort of anonymously by a guest or a participant early on in the conference. And he said, in that context, is it a good thing that 10% of our GDP is in financial services? Are we getting our money's worth, and would we prefer that was higher or lower? And this is sort of analogous to Daniel's discussion of Fogel and what value added really comes out of financial services. But I'm very interested in the panel's view on whether we're sort of rent seekers or whether the economy is getting value out of our contribution. All right, are you?
Yeah, well, I'm the only person up here who's not conflicted, so let me answer this question. I think one thing which is important to remember, and I'm sure Christopher Zinn would be happy for me to say this, the financial sector is an intermediate sector. It is not an end, generator of utility. It is an intermediate sector, and I think that's one thing which you've always got to keep in mind when thinking about any number of things from remuneration to the size of the sector. So I think that's the appropriate way to think about it. I mean, Daniel raised this point earlier, and I think it's actually a reasonable question to ask, and to some extent is a question worth asking as part of this project, which is, what is the value that the financial sector is actually delivering here? And as he said earlier, it's a very tough question to ask. But you also said in asking that question, and it's a bit like the railway in many respects, actually, which is basically it's an intermediate sector. It's not an end generator of utility. It helps other, I said this, I think, at the launch, actually. It's basically the oil which helps the economy operate. And that's the framework in which you have to answer that question.
I'm going to ask Deb to come up. But before I do that, I'd just like to thank my terrific panelists here and really appreciate their input into the debate and their thoughts about the work so far and where we can improve it in the future. So please join me in thanking our panelists.